Hi there everyone, my name's Darcy, I'm the editor of the Stage Left podcast, and I'm just dropping in before this episode begins to let you know that we have a brand new merch line available right now. I'm currently wearing one of our black hoodie designs, which has the Stage Left podcast logo on the front, as well as on the back, but on the back it's filled with all the guests that have appeared on the Stage Left podcast. I also have one of our notebooks here, which I absolutely love. It keeps me organised with everything in the podcast. It's ring-binded and lined as well for my convenience. And I just take it everywhere I go so that I always have my notes with me. It's up to date. And it's a small, compact size as well, which helps me save space in my bag. If you want to go check it out, we also have mugs, t-shirts, stickers, more hoodie designs and tote bags as well for you. So head to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me to check out all of our merch and help support the podcast so that we can keep producing free educational content for you all. Without further ado, let's get on with the episode.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for emerging musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring members of Radiohead, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, the Stone Roses, Elbow, Queen, Guns N' Roses, Fleetwood Mac, the 1975 Oasis and Kraftwerk, alongside conversations with the likes of Stuart Lee and musicians and producers who've worked with Bjork, Olivia Rodrigo, Sabrina Carpenter, Elvis Presley and David Bowie. Today's guest is Smashing Pumpkins and Peter Hook and the light bassist Jack Bates, who's held down the low end stroke high end, depending which band he's faithfully playing with that night, playing back catalogues of the likes of Joy Division and New Order, which, no pressure, just happens to contain some of the most recognisable bass lines ever written. We'll be talking today about what it's like to grow up around one of music's most distinctive legacies, the technical and emotional reality of playing songs that mean so much to so many people, and what happens when Billy Corgan and Peter Hook fight over needing him on the same day. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Jack Bates. Thanks for joining us today, Jack. How's it going?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, mate. How are you? Thanks for having us on.
Good, good, good. Yeah, thank you very much. So I alluded to it there that you are such a busy person, because when I noticed the gigs that you've had in the kind of previous couple of years and coming up this year, that the tours basically are almost like passing ships and you've got to jump on both of those ships at different times. How do you manage your current kind of work-life balance, and what is home to you for the next year?
Well, home is Manchester. So I live in Manchester. I always have. Went to uni in Manchester. I've never really left. I know that sounds like boring, but that's sort of counteracted by the fact that obviously I work away a lot. So it actually helps that Manchester is like the one consistent thing for me. So it actually does feel like coming home, even when you've been away for 3 weeks or 3 months. So I live in Manchester. Obviously, I tour a lot. And, can be quite difficult sometimes, because like you said, sometimes they are passing ships, but sometimes they're not. So I'm quite lucky in the sense that we sort of, with my dad's band anyway, we found a good way of sort of dealing with it, where we have two or three people who will come in and fill in for me sometimes at short notice, which I'm very grateful for, and they do a great job. Like, the show doesn't suffer. So at once, and I think at first it was daunting for my dad, because this was really our thing that we did together. And then as soon as he'd started done a few shows without me being there, everything got a bit easier, because from his standpoint, he was like, okay, we can still do it. Because I think at first it was like, because I do a lot for him as well as playing. I do all of his social media, I do all the merch. And even when I'm not there, I still do all that. So I feel like I'm still involved even when I'm not stood on the stage, which is quite nice as well.
And obviously you don't have to go into contracts or anything like that, but was there a conversation at some point between the two bands, which was, what happens if both acts get a like an offer they can't refuse on the same day or the same weekend, for instance, and how that would be prioritized?
Not really, no. I mean, I've been quite lucky in the sense that most of the time it works out. There's only ever been a few times that haven't, and then it just really depends on what the bigger picture is. Do you know what I mean? If I've got a one-off with my dad that's going to be in the middle of a massive 3-month thing with the Pumpkins, then the decision is made itself, because it doesn't make sense for anybody to pick the one off. Do you know what I mean? So I provided that Paul or Eves, the two guys that come in and play bass when I'm not there, are available, which most of the time they have been. That's how we avoid the conflicts, really. As long as everybody knows, like, in advance, it's when it's short notice that's the problem. I mean, my dad is insane in that he has his whole thing booked out for the next 18 months at any point. And so, like, I literally know what I'm doing with him now at the end of 2027. And then his manager will always say to me, like, okay, we're approaching the point where I'm going to start looking at booking travel for this. So do you want to work out your schedule, or what are we doing? So we kind of just play it by ear that way. And it helps that my dad is so organized, and most people don't work to that sort of time frame. But yeah, he likes to know what he's doing for at least the next 12 to 18 months, which sort of helps the guys in the band, really.
That's interesting. And also, I noticed with the set list, obviously, I mean, he plays a lot, or you both play a lot of songs in those shows. And sometimes, you know, they'll play, you'll play like entire records by the, you know, Nord or Joy Division, and then maybe, you know, a bit of a best of from both bands.
Uh-huh.
How in advance do you know the set list? And are you now having to just be ready to play any kind of anything from that back catalogue?
Sort of. I mean, it's actually me that picks the set list.
Oh, nice. What a geek.
Yeah, he's,
oh, mate,
he's not,
that's amazing.
He's not that bothered in the sense of, you know, from night to night going, here's what we're going to play. We kind of just, we get together in rehearsals 3 weeks, 2 weeks before the tour. And then obviously we'll go, okay, so we're focusing on this album as the main thing of the tour. And recently that's been the Get Ready album by New Order, which came out in 2001. So it's, the timing's pretty good because we can call it 25th anniversary. So nice. we've been doing that. But, you know, the album's only 10 songs. And he likes to play long shows. So it made sense to go, okay, well, essentially that's like the opening band. We come out, we play for 50 minutes or whatever the album is, a couple of extras, because there's some great singles from that era that and not on the album that New Order never played. So we like playing those too. And then we'll just have a break and then come out and play like a 90-minute set, which most bands would probably do for their whole gig. And his thing is that, you know, he's got a lot of music. He's got a lot of great songs. And certainly the way, I mean, I don't want to slag anybody off, but the way New Order is now, they don't play a lot of those songs. Or they won't play a lot of those songs. And that was part of my dad's frustration in New Order towards the end. So his thing now is that he wants to play his music, and he knows that people want to hear those songs. And, you know, sometimes if that means we don't play Blue Monday because he wants to play Everything's Gone Green or some other deep cut that never gets played, you know, we do it. And if most of the time people sort of accept it, we do get the odd complaint when we drop things like Blue Monday. But we're lucky in the sense that people follow us around and come to multiple gigs. And so when you start seeing the same faces at the front, you want to make it different for them as well. So we try our best to cover a lot. So we'll sort of get together in rehearsal and go like, well, okay, on the last tour, which for us was the UK at the end of last year, and then we did Europe like last month. So when we got together rehearsing for that, it was okay. Well, on the UK tour, we played like 70 songs total.
Wow.
Across 12 gigs. So 10 are the same every night, and then the next 20 just changes. So essentially, you've got like 55 songs to condense into 20 for each show. So sometimes some big ones get left out, and that's just the way it is.
I mean, that is the cool, I think that's such a cool thing that you're in a position where you are choosing the set. That's almost like a dream gig for every musician. So what's your process? So like, how do you decide and how late on do you decide? Let's say you've got a gig on, you're playing Wednesday, Friday, Sunday. When are you deciding what the set lists are for the Wednesday, Friday, Sunday gig?
So I will, obviously, when we get to rehearsal, we'll play through all those songs. And most of them will just blast through once because, you know, the songs you played for 15 years, you know, at this, and the lineup of the band, other than me sort of floating in and out sometimes, hasn't changed. So we don't need to practice songs like Disorder or Love Will Tear Us Apart or Ceremony because we've just played them so much. So we'll just blast through everything. And if something sounds a bit ropey, we'll do it twice.
Yeah.
And then we get to the point where we're sort of ready to go. Because ultimately, your tour is get ready album tour. Like, that's what you're billing it as. So that's really the pressure point of the show, because you want that to be as good as possible, since that's the reason why you're going out there. The hits bit is kind of a bonus for people, but it is also important that you get it right. I would say sort of at the start of a tour, I'll probably write out like the first four or five shows, and then making sure I sort of cover everything. And then after a show, I'll post the set list on our Instagram so people can see. But that also helps me to go, that's what we played that night. Oh, that's not been played for 4 days. Let's put that back in, you know? So then we'll just mix it up as we go. And then in the morning, I'll just put what I think the set list is going to be in our little group chat about 10 o'clock in the morning. And then I call it the moaning window is open for 2 hours if anyone's got any problems. And then once the moaning window is closed, the set list is fixed. And then I'll sort of, my dad has a little like lyric prompter thing that I will do. And once I've done that, it's over. Like, we're not changing it because it takes like 20 minutes. So that's pretty much the way it goes. Yeah. And the guys in the band are also happy to play the mixed up sets, because we don't want it to feel like boring for us or the audience. So obviously there's some songs that get played all the time, but a lot of it is pretty fluid.
Now, there'll be some listeners, including my, obviously I'm listening to you speaking here, but like we think about set lists for our bands like way too much. Like it's so, you can almost become consumed in that type of thing. So I think I find that so fascinating. I learned that when Radiohead tour, they will go onto Setlist FM and see what songs they played in the in that particular city. So, oh, right, oh, that's good. Okay.
I mean, some places, it's funny with us, some places we play a lot and some places we don't. So if we've started to play somewhere a lot, I'll look at the last couple and go, well, you know, we've played that 3 times in a row, so maybe skip that. Or if it's somewhere we haven't been for a long time, then it's sort of like, okay, we're going to have to put all the big ones in. So you don't want to, because there's going to be people who've never seen you. So it's a bit of a balancing act. But I will sort of generally do it on the day and then let everybody else have that sort of input into, oh, no, I don't like that. I don't feel like doing that one. Oh, my voice is a bit strained. I don't want to sing that one, you know. So then we'll change it. So
then you change it up.
Yeah.
Oh, so fascinating. Thank you for sharing. So what I'm also interested in is, so every listener to this podcast or viewer of this podcast will have seen bands with two singers in the past. They've seen bands with two guitarists. They may have seen some bands with two drummers as well. But you've got two bassists playing, right? Your dad's playing bass and you're playing bass. So I'm not surprised, but when you said that you turned up, rehearsed something once and you crack on, how do you define who's playing what when? Is that the most complicated bit? And are there times where you play together and is that just doing octaves, or how does that work?
Yeah, so obviously when this whole thing started, my dad had never been the front man of a band. He was always the bass player for Joy Division or New Order or Monaco or any of his other acts. And so when he decided that he was going to be singing, he can sing and play, but he's not the best at it. So then it sort of opened up that spot of, okay, well, we're going to need to have a second bass player. And to be fair, like Monaco, one of his side project bands, sort of mid-90s, was where he first had the second bass player. So like Monaco would have a guy at the back who sort of played a bit of bass, played a bit of keys, you know, just a bit of everything. And it's generally just to do with working around what my dad's doing vocally. So I mean, I don't like that we do have some songs that he doesn't play bass on, just because it doesn't work around the singing to come in and out too much. And I don't like that personally. I think he should be playing bass on every song, but I get it that, you know, it's not always possible. So there's not that many, but I will always sort of try and to me, the show should always start. The first thing you hear is his bass, because that's why everybody's here. So there's a few songs that work really good as openers for that reason. I would never put a song first that he doesn't play bass on, you know, because if people haven't seen you, they'd be like, what am I watching? But ultimately, as the show progresses, it becomes clear the way we do it. So yeah, we do play together, mainly in sort of different registers. You know, we don't just play the same thing. Sometimes we do, and it sounds massive when we do, which is great. But most of the time we're playing slightly different things in different areas of the bass, so it doesn't clash too much. So we do play together, but most of his bass playing these days is sort of woven around what he's singing, which ultimately means, you know, intros, solos, middle eights, that sort of thing will be where he drops in and out, which are predictably all the glory moments. But, you know, that's fair, isn't it? He wrote them, so he should be playing them. And then sort of I'll be playing the majority of my bass playing with his band will be is sort of foundational, as opposed to, I mean, some of them I do play the big sort of solo parts, but most of the time the role is to back him up, not really to be the bass player, you know?
And that's so interesting. And actually, you might know that when Freddie Mercury passed away, Brian May did a similar thing where he went and played, it was called the Brian May Experience, and he was lead singer and didn't play any of the lead guitar parts apart from kind of, say, the middle eights and that type of thing. He hired a guy called Jamie Moses to play it, who later played in Queen, which is super interesting. Okay, so interesting. This might be the most annoying question you'll ever ask, but have you ever played World in Motion?
Yes, we've played it a few times, and we're quite selective with it because but the problem with World in Motion is it was actually one of New Order's biggest songs. Obviously got to number one for the World Cup in 1990. The only problem with that song is it's so heavily programmed and sequenced that other than the vocals, there's not a lot of live instrumentation on it. So when we play it, it kind of feels a bit awkward because we're sort of stood around not doing much. Well, that's the way the song is. Yeah, we do for that one. Yeah,
you do. So, what the John Barnes part? Who does that?
We would normally get friends of my dad's who would fancy having a go at it to come up and do it, and then because you know you can't really stand there and be serious while that is going on. So it kind of developed into okay, who's doing the rap tonight? And somebody will come out and do it. And sometimes they're terrible. Sometimes they've been good. We'll see.
So obviously you would have been asked a million times about your dad's role in being the role model of you getting into the music industry, but who were other male role models for you growing up away from your dad?
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, obviously my dad is such a strong role model to me that it's probably kind of overlooked anybody else really, especially as soon as I started getting into music. I mean, I had a couple of teachers that are really looked up to growing up, but ultimately, you know, my dad and my mum separated when I was very small, but I was still seeing my dad all the time. He wasn't like an absent dad, so he was always there, and he's definitely the main one. Yeah, I mean, it's in terms of everything, really, not just music, just, you know, being a good person, doing what you think is right, and you know, and you can have fun at the same time. And he's done things that are absolutely crazy. And that helps too, because it shows you that you probably shouldn't do that, which helps.
Well, I was going to say, what does a great dad do? So I've got a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, and it's a question that I think about weekly. You know, what does a great dad do? From your perspective, where you've had someone in such a high profile and been so successful over a long period of time as well, how would you answer that question?
I think, I don't have kids, so I don't know much about being a dad from that standpoint. I've got a little niece that I look after, and that's sort of enough for me because you can give her back when she cries. You know what I mean? So I don't know. I would say just being there, and he always has been there. If I ever need him, even if he's on tour, I can just phone him whatever time. And we speak every day, even if it's just for 2 minutes, you know, just checking in, what you're doing, what you're up to. Even if I'm seeing him later that day, I'll still speak to him in the morning. So for me, it's just that he's always been there, which has helped.
Love it. And was there any point where, because right now we'll have listeners to this podcast who will be emerging artists, maybe in their early 20s, and they will have their parents in their ear saying, time to get a proper job. And I'm putting that in inverted commas for those who aren't watching. And they might be discouraged from going into the music industry. And I lie awake at night thinking, oh, all the amazing David Bowies or John Lennons, whoever might have been, who ended up getting a job as an accountant or whatever because they had that pressure. I'm interested that it sounds like your dad was quite proactive in getting you into, you know, starting Peter Hook and the Light with you. So was there any discouragement?
Yeah. Was there any point? The thing with Peter Hook and the Light was that it wasn't supposed to be a thing that went past two shows. One show, really. So it was 2010. was 30 years since Ian Curtis died. And what my dad doesn't like, you know, in the press, whether 30 years since he died or 30 years commemorative of his death, you know what I mean? So he decided, I'm going to do a gig 30 years on where we celebrate his life and what he did by playing the music, because New Order won't play that music for whatever reason. So that was supposed to be a one-off, and it was a small club in Manchester, 400 people. It blew out straight away, so we did a second night. And then the intention was that was going to be it. Like, legit, I'm not just saying it. And everybody says, and then it turned into this big thing. Like, that was all we had. And then probably about 2 weeks after that, we started getting offers from everywhere to go, like big festivals and Australia and all these crazy places. And at that point, I was at uni.
What were you studying?
I was studying Spanish, Portuguese, and Latin American studies at Manchester.
To what end? What, did you have a plan in mind?
Not at the time. I mean, I would have gone into something, you know, translating or something abroad, probably. And I was just getting ready to go into my third year, which would have been 6 months Barcelona, 6 months Porto. But I wasn't really enjoying the course. I was sort of thinking I should have gone. I got into a few other unis and maybe I should have gone there rather than staying here. Sort of a bit disillusioned. And this all started kicking off at a good time for that, really. So I did actually leave uni to do this halfway through, which my mum wasn't happy about. But it's one of them, in hindsight, you know, it worked out. But it might not have done. Who knows? Sometimes you got to take a risk, don't you? And it, when it looked like this was going to be a proper thing, you know, initially I did a year's like pause to my studies. They let you do what they call an interruption. So I thought, you know, probably not going to last more than 6 months or whatever. And then obviously 16 years later, we're still doing it. So I have no regrets. Like, it would have been nice to finish my course and have something to show for all that student loan that I took. I'm still paying back. But it's one of those things, isn't it? Sometimes when something presents itself, you just got to do it. Otherwise you'll think, oh, I should have done that. Should have done that.
And what amazing experience for you and your dad. Can you think of a time on stage where you and your dad, it felt less like a gig and more of a kind of personal memory unfolding between the two of you?
Feels like that every time. I'm not just saying that. It does. It feels like that every time, especially if I've sort of been away for a while with the Pumpkins, and then I'll come back and play that sort of first show back with my dad, where we'll sort of be like, oh, here we go. You know, it doesn't feel like work. The rest of it feels like work, like social media and merch and dealing with venues and all that crap that you have to do on top of the fun bit. But most of the time, it doesn't feel like work. So every gig sort of feels like that. I mean, we just did a European tour last month, 12 gigs in Europe, and then we sort of had a 4 or 5 day break and then played London at the end of it, opening for the Damned, which was great, at Wembley. And all of those shows were really fun. We had a great time. The vibe was good, even when everybody inevitably got sick during the tour, because whatever bug's going around at the moment nailed us all. We still had a good time. And yeah, it didn't feel like work at any point really on that tour, which was nice.
So if you watch a lot of films, and I do a lot of this, there's so many films where there are, the subplot is a son trying to get the validation from their father. Whoa. And it's like, oh, dad, tell me you're proud of me. And it never happens. And it's just like, I can't, now I've mentioned it to people. Next time you watch like 5 films in a row, you'll see it come up at like 2 or 3 times. How does that work with your dad? Because obviously he's, you know, you're being validated by the fact you're in a band with him and that type of thing. But how does that kind of, where does your validation come from, both with him and even on stage? So some people, you know, explore internal validation, which is, I know this is good, so I don't have to worry what other people think. But then we do have a culture as well where a lot of people feel they need to get that feedback and that external validation to be told what they're doing is shit hot. So where do you sit on that very difficult tightrope that we all walk along?
No, he's always been very forthcoming with praise and telling me that he's proud of what I'm doing, which is really nice. And, you know, he's, the main thing for me is that he's there for advice, to ask questions. Like, I've, any situation that I find myself in my own sort of musical path, most likely he'll have been there at some point and is a good sounding board. So we're very communicative, and he's always very forthcoming with telling me that I'm doing a good job. You know, telling me that he's proud of me, which is always what you like to hear. And we don't have one of those where it's like, oh, he hugged me for the first time in 5 years. You know what I mean? It's the opposite of that, really. So it's, he's always been very, he's always the first one when we'll, you know, we'll do some TV show with the Pumpkins or whatever. He's always the first one to be like, oh, I've just seen you on telly. Great job, you know? So he's always been very forthcoming with that sort of stuff, which has been nice, yeah.
Hi everyone, it's Darcy again. I'm just interrupting the episode briefly to let you know that our merch line is available right now. We have hoodies, mugs, notebooks, tote bags, stickers, t-shirts, anything you can imagine online right now to help you support the podcast. So head to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me to go grab yourself some lovely Stage Left merch and help us support the podcast so that we can keep producing free and educational content for you all. I won't keep you too long, so let's get back to the episode.
And we're going to come to the Pumpkins in a moment, but you worked with Mark Lanegan, right?
Uh-huh.
And I think you worked on his last album before he passed away, is that right? Tell us about that experience and what was unique in the studio, because you actually worked in the studio, I believe, with him.
Yeah.
What was unique about seeing him work in the studio?
So he was always one of my musical heroes. I'm very much like a 90s grunge kind of guy. That was what I grew up listening to, and Screaming Trees was a part of that. And obviously that developed into a massive solo career that Mark had, which I actually ended up liking more than the previous stuff that he'd done with Screaming Trees, which was cool. And I mean, some of those later albums were amazing of his. Like the and that's what's criminal about losing him at 57, because he would have been done a few more albums for sure. That obviously we won't get now, which is a real shame. But he is a massive fan of my dad. And my dad at the time didn't really know who he was, but we would used to share an iTunes, me and him. So whenever he was in the gym, he would just put his iTunes on shuffle. And most of the time it would be a lot of my music that he listened to. So that's how he got into Lanegan. So he started asking me questions. He's the guy with the deep voice. I really like that. Really like that song. And I'll go, you know, he loves you. And he's like, what? Because the music doesn't sound like, I mean, some of his later stuff sounded a bit Joy Division-y in the vibe, but my dad'd be like, really? I'm like, yeah, you should hit him up. Let's try and do something. You know, my thing was that I wanted my dad to be on a track with Mark. And I think things were going in that direction. I reckon for the next album that he would have done, I think we probably would have had my dad playing on it. Because there's been a couple of times to me where Mark would be like, yeah, I got this guy in to play like your dad on this track. See what you think. And I'm like, why don't you just ask my dad? And it's almost like they're sort of scared of communicating with each other, which is quite funny. But it was that happened by accident, really, that I was just in LA at the end of a tour with the Pumpkins in 2019. And I have a really good family friend who lives there that if we finish a tour in LA, I'll just stay out for a couple of weeks rather than going home immediately, you know, just decompress and be somewhere warm. So I was just there. And I sort of hit him up and just said, like, you know, do you want to get a brew or whatever? Because at this point, we were friends and he'd sang with Peter Hook and the Light a few times live. And then he was like, I'm actually doing a record and the guy that normally plays bass isn't here. So it's like, are you free tomorrow? I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll be there. And I didn't even have a guitar. So I had to call up Scott from Yamaha, who's like a massive support to us, and be like, mate, have you got a guitar that I can use tomorrow to record Mark Lanegan's album? It was just like, oh my god, what am I doing? So I showed up and he was literally recording it in, he had a little home studio in his garage next to his house where he used to live in Glendale, California. And it was just me and him and Alan Johannes, who is a genius multi-instrumental guy who did a lot of Mark's solo music and has done, you know, too many things for me to even mention. it was just the three of us in there for one day. I did five songs, five, I think. Yeah. And then Mark was just sitting in a rocking chair in the corner, and you could sort of tell when you were doing something that he liked because he'd sort of rock a bit harder. So that was the sounding board, really. And that was one of the most exciting days ever, just getting to work with someone who you love. And you'd sort of become like a sort of extended family member at that point for us. And it crushed me when he died, man. I was fucking gutted. But you know, you'll always have the music, and music lives on past all of us. So people will still be finding his music now, which is great. And
what will you miss about him? Or what do you miss about his personality away from music?
You know what? He was really funny. And people may not even think that because of like his demeanor or interviews and all that, where he could sort of sometimes be a bit moody. But yeah, he was fucking hilarious. And just the times where we would hang out, either it's just me, him and his wife, Shelley, or me and him and my dad, and we're just not really talking about music, would be the best times, really. Just to sort of get to know him on more of a personal level. And you know, like the first time I met Mark was 2004 or 5, I think. I was about 17. He was touring with Isabel Campbell, and they were playing at the Manchester Cathedral, and the fire alarm went off in the middle of the gig because a roadie backstage was making toast and set the fire alarm off, so the whole building got evacuated.
Wow.
And as we were walking out, because the gig didn't go back on, we were all leaving, and he was just stood there smoking. And me and my mate Rick, who sort of, he's like my gig buddy, we were like, we're going to have to do it. We got to go say hello to Lanigan. And we went over and he just told us to piss off, which is amazing. Because, you know, he's annoyed about his fucking gig going down halfway through. The last thing he wants is two spotty teenagers coming over and trying to get a photo with him. So when I told him that, he laughed and apologized, which was quite funny. I was like, no, mate, it just added to the experience.
That's the full experience. And it's an interesting record there, because there's some other interesting players on this. Ed Hardcore played on some of the songs, I think even you played on, and yeah. Adrian Utley from Portishead as well.
Yeah, he had a lot of guests on that one. I mean, it was like the, it's called Straight Songs of Sorrow, for anyone who wants to listen to it. And it was like the musical accompaniment to the book that he just put out or was putting out at the time. And I think a lot of those songs, certainly lyrically, were inspired by what he was going back through to put in his book. So it was quite an interesting time, really. And it came out towards the end of COVID, I think, which was nice as well, because we were all feeling a bit crap then. And then finally this thing came out that we'd worked on. So that was amazing. It was a little bright moment during COVID.
One of the things that we have that comes up quite a lot from our listeners is, if you're a stage left musician, so you're not the front person, is how best to receive feedback and actually give feedback to other people within bands. So can you think of a really specific moment where maybe a singer or front person gave you feedback that really stuck with you? Like, what exactly did they say? And also, like, how did they say it that really worked and helped you develop your skills or do something differently?
One thing that springs to mind is 2010, on the first American tour that we did as Peter Hook and the Light, when none of us even got paid. Like, my dad was just doing it for the crack, really, to get out there. And we just sort of went along with him. I think he gave us like $100 a gig, but that was gone on like feeding yourself. You know what I mean? Nobody made any money. But, you know, the fact that it's credit to the guys in the band and my dad, because the fact that we did that then has helped us get to where we're at now in America, where we play bigger shows than we do in the UK. So again, that's like another thing of sometimes you just got to take that risk and see what happens. And another band that I always loved growing up was Jane's Addiction. Perry has always been very vocal about his love for Joy Division and New Order. And I would say to my dad, like, a couple of years before, my dad had worked on his solo album called Satellite Pie, played a few tracks on it. And I'd said to Perry, to my dad, like, you should ask Perry to come and sing a song in LA, you know, because Jane's Addiction are like the kings of LA. But why would you do, like, we're going to be there. Let's just see if he'll come and do it. And my dad's like, oh, you won't want to do that. And anyway, we emailed him and we asked him if he fancied coming down and singing Transmission. And he just replied saying, what color will the band be wearing? I was like, okay, he's coming. And then I remember halfway through that gig, we had a little interval and he was there with his manager. And he was sort of saying to us, like, we're in tears over hearing these Joy Division songs that we never thought we'd hear. And at that point, early on, where I was like 20, you know, I couldn't even drink a beer in America yet. And my dad was sort of finding his feet, doing this thing on his own and wondering if it was even going to go anywhere. Having him say that to us was really helpful. So that's what springs to mind there for sure.
That's a great one.
Yeah.
And you just talked about the fan interaction you had with Mark Lanegan. Have you ever had any fan interaction that genuinely stayed with you in some way? I mean, that's a good example there. But how do you find, you know, obviously your dad's kind of under the main spotlight, but well, you must also have other people come up to you as well. So can you think of any fan interactions that genuinely stayed with you?
I mean, I'm lucky in the sense that I've met a lot of people who I'm a fan of. And so the lines are a bit blurred for me in terms of like being a fan versus being a friend, you know, and it's like what my sort of, one of my biggest bass heroes is Eric Avery from Jane's Addiction. Mm. And I talk to him all the time on text, but never about music.
Interesting.
Which is quite interesting. It's always about football.
How nice.
So it's one of them things where, you know, I would love to ask him all sorts of hundreds of nerdy questions about bass pedals and guitars and shit like that. But it's actually quite fun in the sense that you have this relationship and it's not actually that. And I don't know, it's quite interesting to think that, you know, I could ask him, what's the secret of that bass sound on Ritual? You know, I'm just, he doesn't want to hear that because, you know, you sometimes you don't want to be a fan all the time. It's just nice to, it's nicer to get to know people on a different level. So I don't know. I try not to, when I meet people, I try not to be fanboyish just in case.
And my question is actually coming from what about people meeting you? So can you think of any fan interactions with people meeting you and the band that's kind of stayed with you?
I mean, certainly on my dad's tours, we meet a lot of people. We're not hiding, you know, we're out the front of the venue getting food or hanging around. It's a little bit different on the Pumpkins tours because obviously like the arenas are massive and security everywhere and you can't really go out like that. I mean, I still do because I'm the only one that can still walk around undetected. And most people are super nice. I mean, I wouldn't be able to remember one that sticks out, but I meet a lot of people and the vast majority of them are super nice and supportive. It's only online where you get the haters.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is really interesting. And yeah, I find that whole culture really fascinating. Mm. And it's interesting your dad's experience. And I wonder if you ever spoke to him about this, but through doing the podcast, I've had some experiences where I've been maybe stood with people who are receiving that level of adulation. And I remember thinking, wow, when I grew up wanting to be a musician, it never quite happened. I kind of assumed that I always wanted that. But then when you see it through their perspective, I can actually think that's quite unhealthy to be on the receiving end over a long period of time. Like the novelty would wear off after a certain period of time.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Yeah, it's quite interesting. I never really thought about that. I don't know. It's interesting because I see people freak out like when they meet my dad.
Yeah.
And at first, that when I was young, that was like weird for me to get my head around because, you know, it's just your dad. Obviously, as I've grown up, I understand why, because, you know, he's done what he's done and people love that music and it means a lot to them. But that certainly was a weird one to get my head around at first.
Yeah. And we would all, you know, freak out to there's no judgment here about, but, you know, I would have been like that meeting someone when I was, you know, younger as well. But it's just how it impacts the person who's on the receiving end of it. And it's just this interesting slight obsession that a lot of, you know, our listeners may have about trying to make it and that fame. And that's why I started the Stage of Podcast, which is like, you could be sat on the tube next to someone who's played Wembley Stadium and you don't always have to be the front person. You don't always have to get that.
Yeah,
that's
cool.
Adulation. And just what the actual impact is on those individuals. It's kind of an interesting one. I was at a bar not long ago and the person I was with, this fan came over and said, oh, she had this weird piece of paper and she asked us to sign it. And I was like, what's that all about? And it was because she was signing for a tattoo, and that was what she was going to go and tattoo. And it's like,
yeah, we've had a few of those with my dad. Like, oh, can you sign my arm? I'm going to go and get it tattooed tomorrow.
Yeah,
and he's like, whoa.
It's interesting, but it's really cool as well. Yeah, and it shows the.
To be fair, like that's what I like about my roles, in the sense that I'm not the megastar. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I can walk around venues out front undetected and watch the support bands, and just I like that. You know, I like that where I'm at is a nice level of not people really not knowing who you are, because I can still sort of mill around on a gig day and. You know, I like walking around the crowd, and I like watching the opening bands from the crowd.
Yeah, nice.
Being on the side of the stage is cool, but it sounds shit. I want to go out front.
So true.
I've been so lucky in the last few years that with the Pumpkins, we've had a lot of bands that I love open for us. We're Interpol, Stone Temple Pilots, Jane's Addiction. And it's like, I'm going to be out there, man. Because I want to watch that shit from out front where it sounds great. And so that is what I like being able to do, that I can just blend in with the crowd. Because obviously, like, James or Jimmy can't do that, because they'll just get mobbed by the fans. So it's quite interesting that I can still do that, and I do like doing that.
Without giving too many creative secrets away, having played so many like iconic bass lines, if we have emerging bassists listening to this, which we will, what's maybe something an emerging bassist might misunderstand about what makes a part memorable?
That's an interesting one. I mean, it's. I guess in my dad's band, there's so many parts that are like solos almost and lead bass playing, which is quite interesting. But also, in that sense, there is still a bass part underneath that's maybe even more important to the song. So obviously, like, if we're playing a song like Regret and my dad's doing this iconic bass solo, of course I want to play that, but you've got to remember it only sounds great because of what else is going on underneath it. And so I would sort of say, from that standpoint, you have to remember, like, what you're doing is just as important, even though the spotlight might not be on it as hard.
So let's talk about working with the Smashing Pumpkins. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a gig. I mean, you must be so proud working.
Yeah, I love it. I really, really enjoy it. It's been an amazing experience from day one.
What's one gig that you've played that, if I could give you the ability to go and watch it from the crowd's perspective, would you watch with the Smashing Pumpkins?
Probably my first one.
Tell us about that. You could put a VR headset on the rest of us and talk us through that first gig.
I mean, it was interesting because, so 2015, they needed a bass player, and the tour was going to start in July. And I got the call in like May or late April, May, from Jeff, who has since left the band, who was the guitar player. And I showed up. I didn't audition. Like, there was no audition process for getting the gig. It was kind of just expected that you could do the gig. Do you know what I mean?
Wow.
So it was like, nice. we had 5 days rehearsal. And obviously I was really nervous, but I was like, you know, just focus. And I knew I could play those songs. And I knew those songs in and out from being a fan of the music already. I could play
They given you a list of songs that were likely to be in the set list, or did you just have to learn the whole back catalogue?
No, he sent a set list for that first tour, so I knew what I was working on. But then what was quite funny was a few weeks before, there was like a change of plan, and Jimmy, the drummer, was coming back too. So that set list that I had been sent completely changed like the week before. So I was just freaking out, you know, because then he's like, oh, now we'll do this song and we'll do that song. And so it did change a lot, and I was freaking out. And I remember at the first gig, you know, I was stood there playing, and it was happening, and it sounded great, and everyone was happy. But I was thinking, like, I'm not even thinking about what I'm doing here, because I'm that nervous that I'm almost like not present, even though it's happening. So I don't know if I could go back and watch that gig as a punter, it'd be quite interesting just to see how nervous I looked. I don't know. It's quite interesting because now I'm, you know, we've done it so much. You still get nervous because I think that's good. Like one thing that my dad says is, if you don't get nervous, you know, that's bad because it means you don't care.
Nice.
But the fact that you're still getting nervous is great.
If we were to drill down on that, what are you nervous about?
I don't know, really. I mean, it probably just fucking up.
Yeah,
I guess. I don't know. Like nobody, you know, when somebody fucks up, everyone else finds it hilarious. You know, it's not like you're going to get... It's not like you're going to get fired or shouted at, but in your head, it's like, oh my God, I played a bum note. You know, that's the sort of thing.
And 99.9% of the crowd won't recognize
exactly,
it.
Exactly, yeah. And then another one that my dad says is, well, just do it, play the bum note twice, make it look like you meant to do it.
Nice.
Which is quite, that's what he's made a career on. But yeah, I don't know really. It's interesting. I don't know what I get nervous about. Just being in front of that many people, I guess.
Were you an introvert or extrovert growing up?
Probably more of an introvert, yeah.
Yeah. So I find it fascinating. A lot of the stage left musicians I interview, they're all introverts who are doing this such extroverted, you know, job.
I know, yeah. It's mad. Well, I mean, I'm still a bit of an introvert when I get home. You know, me and my missus just like sitting at home and watching telly. We don't really go out all the time. And then obviously, so you go from that to playing these massive gigs, which is quite jarring sometimes, especially when you've sort of had a few months off and you're thrown back into it. It takes you a few goes to sort of get your head around what you're doing again.
So who is Jack Bates when you are on stage that you aren't off stage? What part of your personality dials up when the gig starts?
God, I don't know. I mean, I like to think I'm the same in terms of, you know, I'm a steady person that you can rely on, and I will do the job to the best of my ability. And I think that applies to being, you know, being an uncle like I am, or being a bass player. You know, it's the same thing, isn't it? You just look at everything that way. I'll be present, and I'll be there, and I'll work my ass off. And that's pretty much the way I live every aspect of life, really.
Good. What do you think is an underrated skill every musician should have if they want to make it in the music industry? So beyond just playing their instrument, what do you think is an underrated skill that every musician should have?
I mean, obviously you have to live with people in very close quarters on a tour bus. So just knowing when to shut up, maybe. Knowing when to be quiet, and just knowing when to just chill. You know, we don't have to always be rabbiting on for 8 hours talking about whatever in the bus. Sometimes it's nice to just sit there and just be quiet and decompress. Right. Just be easy to be around. I think that's really important for going on tour. You know, you could be the best bass player ever, and there are way better bass players than me, but maybe they're not good. Maybe they're not a good hang. I don't know. So for me, it's just be mellow. That's the way I like to be, you know, just be easy to be around.
Love it. Thank you so much. On the back of that, if for our bassists who are listening and they're, you know, they're touring at the moment, you've talked in the past, you've done interviews where you said that locking in with Jimmy, you feel like you're really, you know, locked in when you play together as a rhythm section.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to analyze, like, what is the secret of that? Because you would have tried to lock in with lots of drummers, and it's, for some it might have been quicker than others, and some you actually might not have done. So what do you think, if you were to like advise someone to fast track that process, is it playing together lots? Is it finding a similar vibe that you're kind of interested? Is it not about playing live with them? What do you think is the secret to that?
You just got to be a good listener. And Jimmy doesn't play the same things every night. So
right, okay.
I have to, you know, he'll play the same song differently 5 nights in a row, you know, because he's still figuring out what feels good for him on that song. So he'll do a crazy fill one night that he won't do the next night, then he'll do it somewhere else. Or sometimes he'll flip the time signature around just
really
to make it fun for himself. Like, you know, I'm so lucky to be able to play with him, because he is one of the greatest drummers that's ever lived, you know. And what's really interesting about him is he's got this sort of jazz background that he brought into the rock arena. And it's sort of, there's no rules for his drumming. He does what feels right for him that day. So for me, it's like, I have to just listen to that and go, and I'll know a couple songs in, like, oh, he's throwing some crazy stuff around tonight. So I'll know, like, I'm just going to try and be extra sort of steady to let him go off and do that. Because I know, as a Pumpkins fan, which I am still, that's what I want. I want Jimmy going off doing all kinds of crazy drumming. So if my role can be an enabler of that to happen just by being super steady and by listening to what he's doing, you know, because I don't play exactly the same things every time, but I'll think maybe some nights it's good to be steady rather than trying to go off a little bit, because from a fanboy point of view, I want Jimmy to go off more. So I'll sort of be like, okay, I'm here, I'm steady, I'll be here when you get back from doing that crazy fill.
And is that a conversation you ever have? Like, do you ever sit down and have a chat about, you know, it's you talk about football and it feels like when you have two midfielders and one kind of goes forward and the other one holds back and, you know, that type of thing. So is that something that you worked out in rehearsals or conversations?
Never.
Wow.
We never talk about that. I think he just knows that I've told him before, like, dude, I want you to go mental on whatever song. And, you know, when we get to that point, I'll sort of flash a look at him as if to say, like, yeah, I caught that one. You know, nice. So we never talk about it. It just happens on stage. And yeah, he's super fun to play with. Again, it doesn't feel like work, because it just feels like having fun with your friend.
And in fact, many people in bands right now are having rehearsals and for gigs. And how would a Smashing Pumpkins rehearsal before a tour differ from a Peter Hook one, which you said, you know, go in there, we play these songs a million times, so we just need to play it once, twice maximum?
Yeah, there's still a bit of that. Like, obviously, you know, if we're playing something like 1979 or Zero or Bullet, you know, we sort of will just blaster it once. And just a similar sort of, because then you can focus your time better on something that needs more time. Do you know what I mean? If we're going to play something that, if there's a song that I haven't played before that he wants to bring back that they haven't played for ages, you know, that obviously requires more time than something like Zero, which we've played, you know, hundreds of times. So it's about time management, really, and just focusing on things that need it more than others, I think.
How does onstage communication work for a Smashing Pumpkins gig? So obviously you're giving a nod and you know, back and forth with Jimmy, but do you have any ears where you can communicate with each other during the songs? And
we never talk to each other now.
Interesting.
No, not really. I have a talk back mic where I can talk to the monitor guy if I'm like having an emergency. But other than that, no, we never talk to each other on stage. No, we just sort of, I guess the music talks and
doesn't talk.
Again, that's just about listening. You know, sometimes, you know, in the same way that Jimmy will go off, like Billy will too, and sometimes solos will be longer or shorter, you know. So again, there is quite a lot of improvisation involved, especially with some of the songs that are a bit more like jammy sort of, you know. Obviously Zero is like a 2 minute bam, hit you in the face, like that's the song. And you know, that's why it's great. And then sometimes we'll play songs that are, you know, 12 minutes long. And the next night it might be 14, you know. We were playing, there's a song called Gossamer, which is a B-side from, I think, Zeitgeist era. So like 2008, maybe, when he wrote it. And it's never been released properly, but it's sort of like a cult favorite amongst the fans for that reason, in the sense that every version that exists of it is different.
Wow.
And so that is one what we were playing that was different every night, because sometimes he would solo for a minute and a half more than he did the previous night, and we never talk about that. It's just, you've just got to listen and be there to sort of catch it when it comes down.
Amazing.
Yeah,
that's so class. That's so class. That kind of you know, those unwritten rules and those, you know, that kind of non-verbal communication and just doing like that's so so fantastic to hear. Good stuff. Well, so what like
Jimmy particularly like that they have like a telepathic sort of musical relationship, which has obviously been built for 35 years at this point, and you can't substitute that. You know, they know what each other are doing before the other one's done it. It's wild. Yeah.
So what I'd like to do is fast forward a few decades and imagine, Jack, that you're lying in a hammock and you've got a beer or cocktail or non-alcoholic beverage. And you're kind of like 3 months after you've hung up the bass guitar and you're like, right, done now. I've been touring all this time. What do you want to look back having achieved that you haven't got around to yet? Or accomplished or completed?
I mean, I suppose doing your own music is something that I would like to do. I mean, it's just one of them things where I tour so much and I'm making that choice to tour with two different bands and be really busy. So it's my own fault that I don't have time to do that. And, you know, I'm 36 now and not many people drop an amazing debut album at, you know, late 30s. So I'm aware of that. But it's one of them where I'm enjoying what I do so much, playing music that I love as a fan. But it would be nice to be able to do sort of more creative things. But it's just finding the time. I just haven't got the time. And finding the people too, you know, it's difficult.
What type of people are you looking at if it's not filled by Peter Hook's band and members of Smashing Pumpkins?
I suppose it's one of those things where, you know, if I start working with a guitar player in Manchester and we start doing really cool stuff, you know, I then have to expect that person to sort of let us drop everything for 6 months while I go and tour. But then you come back and it might not be the same. You might have lost that spark that you had going. So again, it's like, I don't really want to do that to someone. You know what I mean? If I can't fully commit to it because of all the other shit that I've got going on, then I don't think it's fair really to expect somebody else to sit there and wait for you. So that's part of it too.
What would the record be like? Or if you did do some recording, what would you want it to be like?
You know what? I haven't got a clue. I don't know. I mean, I record so many riffs and stuff that I come up with and never do anything with. You know, I've got a little recorder sitting full of stuff that one day might end up being something, but who knows? I don't know.
Do you sing on it? Would you be the lead vocalist or would you get
that? No, I can't sing at all. I'm a terrible singer. So that's the thing, like, you know, finding people. It's not easy. So okay. I don't know. I haven't got a clue. But I'd love to find out. So I don't know. And I suppose, you know, the big moment where I could have done something was during COVID because we were all sitting at home doing nothing. But I was so inherently miserable for those 2 years that I just didn't even pick up a bass really. So it's just one of them. I didn't get inspired during COVID like some people did.
What's the price you pay for doing this job? Because you've got, you know, you're doing the job that, you know, 99% of musicians out there would love to be able to do. And, you know, just for listeners who aren't aware, I kind of mentioned earlier, but the tours often dovetail. So if you look at your tour days, you're for the Pumpkins and then you're Peter Hook and then there's a small gap, then it's Pumpkins, Peter Hook back and forth. But you barely get a break, which is just living the dreams of many people. Mm. But what's the price you pay for doing this job beyond not being able to do your own music?
Wow. I mean, you know, it isn't great for your health. Not sleeping well and traveling all the time. It, you know, it is hard. Like we're not just living it up all the time, 24/7 on tour. Like it is difficult. And the lack of sleep becomes a problem, especially as I've got older. You know, when I started touring with my dad, I was 20 and, you know, I'm nearly 40 now. Like in a few years, I'll be 40. And it's kind of like, each tour gets a little bit harder as you get older. You know, you want that extra hour in bed or, you know, you're a bit achy. And, you know, I look at him, my dad is 70 and he's fitter.
Is he?
Yeah, wow. He's 70. Yeah. He's fitter than I am. And I'm half his age. Like he's actually cycling to Llandudno and back this week.
Wow.
You know, with his old man cycling friends that he goes cycling with. And, I did it once with him and was absolutely knackered. And, you know, he's leaving me behind in the dust. So he, you know, again, he's an inspiration in that sense as well. And like, he doesn't drink anymore or do anything else naughty. He looks after his body. And, you know, he doesn't come to sound check. He gets to chill all day while we do all the work. But that's how we make it happen. You know what I mean? So he's still up there playing for 2 hours 45 and just bellowing songs out. You know, so he does look after himself, and he is quite disciplined and inspiring in that way, because it does get harder. I've noticed it. I mean, most people would say 36 isn't old, you know what I mean? But it feels it when you started when you were 20. And it feels it sometimes when I wake up in the morning and I've had a really bad night's sleep and you've got to go again. Because we do a lot of three in a rows. We never do more than three in a row, but sometimes that third one is fucking hard, you know? So
you're a gifted and celebrated musician. What kind of bad habits, maybe technically around playing an instrument or warming up and that type of thing, do you have that you would teach a young musician not to do?
For me, it's like, I know it sounds really stupid. Sometimes I will be playing and someone will go, oh, the key's D. And I don't know what I'm doing still. I wish I'd spent more time on scales and all that stuff, and sort of a little bit at least of musical theory would have been nice, but I'm not very good with that sort of stuff. It takes me a minute to sort of figure out where I am and where I should go next, rather than just being able to click your fingers and go off, which is quite interesting. And that's exactly how my dad is as well.
Wow.
And so I wish I'd spent a bit more time on that sort of stuff.
So if someone's saying the key of D, you've literally got to just go...
I know where to start.
It's a 10th fret, yeah. Just so you know.
I know where to start, but then it might take me a minute to figure out where to go next from there without sounding like freeform jazz. So I wish I'd spent a little bit more time on that. But other than... I mean, it's fine. I can do it. It just takes me a minute sometimes.
Last couple of questions. What's the most surreal experience you've had in your 16 years being a musician?
Maybe sitting across from Mark Lanigan in that rocking chair in his garage, because that was just something I never thought I would ever do.
What about another?
We've played some amazing venues that I never thought I'd even walk into, let alone play. So, you know, Hollywood Bowl, Mega with the Pumpkins, amazing. With Jane's Addiction too. It really felt like a big sort of LA special night. Madison Square Garden and all these amazing places. Just being able to be a small part of those venues' history is cool too. And, you know, sometimes when I walk into the Forum in LA, where we played a few times, and, you know, I can see they have like a timeline up on the whole wall of every band that's ever played. And, you know, I walk in and I'm like, I see like 1982, New Order, 1984, New Order, 1986. And I'm like, no way. Like, you know, that is quite surreal sometimes to think that my dad was there 40 years prior, like before I was even born, he was doing it, which is pretty amazing. So it's always a bit surreal walking into the Forum and seeing that timeline.
Amazing. So my last question to you is, we've been asking you for advice throughout for emerging musicians. What's the best bit of advice someone's given you?
Again, it's probably my dad's. Just keep going, no matter what. Just keep going. If you believe in it, do it. And his thing, like, I was... Obviously, this week's been quite a big week for him, because he's been announced that they're finally being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
That's right, yeah.
And so...
Will you be going to that, do you know, or is that undecided?
You know what? You wouldn't believe it, but the Pumpkins have a festival gig the same night, an hour away. So I'll be really, really close. So the ceremony is going to be in LA, like downtown LA. And we are playing a festival called Darker Waves Festival, which is happening on Huntington Beach, which is about an hour away. So I will be around, and I might be able to go to the after party, but I will not be able to be there for him at that moment, which I'm absolutely heartbroken about. Like, of all the dates they could have picked. So it's really annoying. But we've had this sort of big news week for us when we're all really happy for him. And obviously it presents its own problems too, in the sense that New Order is a fractured band and nobody knows what's going to happen on the night. So that's all being dredged up at the moment. But what's interesting about it is I was sitting there at his house a couple of days ago while he was doing press for it. And he was sort of saying, you know, we're only here because we believed in ourselves when everyone else was saying we were shit. And then I was like, well, that is the best advice, isn't it? Self-belief and keep going no matter what. You know, he was talking about a Joy Division gig where there was literally no people there in like 1978. And there was just a guy who worked at the venue in front of him sweeping the floor while they played like Transmission. And then, you know, now Joy Division is revered. And then people weren't interested. So, and even then, you know, he didn't give up. He kept going. And now he's in the Hall of Fame. So I suppose I'd look at it like that. Just self-belief and keep going, keep practicing.
Incredible.
And learn your scales.
Absolutely. Listen, thank you so much for being such an amazing guest on the Stage Left Podcast. I mean, thank you for your wisdom, your insight, kind of your vulnerability as well, sharing kind of things that you still want to work on. Make sure you get that EP done. I think that's really, you know, really important.
Yeah, I would like to. I would like to one day. Stay tuned. In about 10 years, maybe I'll get there.
Get it done. And yeah, brilliant. You know, good luck for the huge tours you have coming up.
Nice
and,
one.
Thanks for being such a great guest on the
Stage
Left
Podcast. Thanks for having us on.
Hi everyone, I hope you enjoyed the episode, but just before you go, I want to drop in again and say that our brand new merch line is available right now. So head to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me to check out all our new hoodies, t-shirts, mugs, stickers, tote bags, notebooks to help support the podcast. If you could go over there and check that out and maybe purchase something, it's an amazing way to help support us and keep us going so that we can produce free and educational content for y'all about the music industry, which really helps a lot of young musicians and people looking to get into the industry. All of the merch is great. I love it. I have the hoodie here and I've also got one of our notebooks. And it's just a great way of helping support us and keep us going as well. So I'd be greatly appreciated if you could head over to the-stageleft-podcast.printify.me and have a little look at all of our merch. It would be so, so, so appreciated. So I hope you enjoyed the episode there and go check out our brand new merch. Thank you for watching.